DadsNet Original Podcast.
Welcome back to DadsNet's Podcast. That's JK, I'm out, and we have got another guest joining us today. Which, without a shadow of a doubt, it's like the most intelligent person we've ever had on the show. And that's no disrespect to everyone else. It's apart just that this guy is like a next level, isn't he?
I mean, it's scary. Next level.
How can you... My brain hurts thinking about him thinking.
Yeah. My brain hurts about him thinking about thinking about... thinking about space.
Yeah. Oh God. Oh, it's agony. Anyway, it's Professor Brian Cox joining us on the podcast, and we get to ask him a bit about parenting, a bit about some questions that you guys listening submitted through DadsNet. We put a post out in DadsNet and said, if you could speak to Brian Cox, what would you ask him? So we kind of collated some of those questions and put those to him. One of which is, are there aliens? Felt so stupid sitting with like one of the biggest brains in the country. I mean, the world at the moment, and me going, do you think there's aliens?
Did you not put a filter on these questions? You didn't have to ask that question.
Well, his answer makes the question not so stupid.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Amazing. Well, actually, but he's good at that. Did anyone ask him, when does space end? Because that's the question.
Like, the first question, not as in like, when's the edge of it?
Yeah.
No, but the very first question we did ask was, when is the world going to end?
Oh.
And let me just tell you,
is it the answer we're looking for?
Well, the fact that there is an answer is quite terrifying. But he does kind of bring it back around. But it's really cool. Like, getting to speak to someone of his caliber.
I haven't even heard this yet. I am looking forward to hearing this.
He's good. He's a nice guy as well. Anyway, this is it. It's Professor Brian Cox.
Welcome to DadsNet's podcast. No JK with me today. Usually I have a co-host, but he's not with me today because I'm on site at Brooklyn's Museum. And instead of JK, perhaps an upgrade, in fact, I'm joined by Professor Brian Cox. Welcome.
You can't say it's an upgrade.
He won't mind. I'm sure he would say the same thing. And Executive Director of Brooklyn Museum, Alex Patterson. Yeah. Welcome.
Thank you.
I've had a look around today and it has been quite a spectacular sight. We'll share more about that afterwards. But first of all, I'd love to ask a couple of questions that some of our listeners have shared. Some of them come from the kids as well. And one that I think probably to get us going, which I think you were asked this morning, which has completely baffled my mind. But the question was, when will the world end?
When will the world end? So I think the question is asked this morning was the Earth, and we can answer that. We know when the sun's going to run out of fuel, and that really is the end of the solar system. And it's about 5 billion years, which is fine. It's burning 600 million tons of hydrogen every second into helium, the sun. So although it's big, you can fit about 1 million Earths inside it, it's not that big. So it's about halfway through its life, and it'll swell up before that into what's called a red giant. So the Earth will be uninhabitable reasonably soon.
Don't panic.
Billion, 2 billion.
Okay.
But then if you mean by the world, you mean the universe, then it's a good question. As far as we understand it at the moment, the universe is going to expand forever. But once the last star has ceased to shine, and arguably, so the last star, we're talking about something like a trillion years, a red dwarf star, then there's no temperature difference. As an engineer, we're at Brooklands, you know that you need a temperature difference to do anything.
Yeah.
So the only thing left, ultimately, for a very long time, will be black holes. And even they have a temperature. So they glow, Stephen Hawking's great discovery. And if you say, well, when does the last black hole disappear then? And then there really is nothing left in the universe. It's something like, in scientific language, 10 to the power 120 years, which is one with 120 noughts after it. And the universe is only one with 10 noughts after it years old at the moment. It's about 10 billion years, give us that's 14 billion years.
We're young.
So we've got a long way to go before the last supermassive black hole evaporates away. But by a long way, that's an understatement.
I mean...
So there you go. So it depends what you mean by what ends.
Yeah.
But Well, of course, we might end ourselves significantly earlier than that.
Yeah.
That's our choice, not nature's.
Sure. I want to come on to that as well a little bit, because that's one of the other questions. But I'm still trying to get my head around that, and in terms of like how that kind of blows one's mind in terms of trying to get your head around these numbers. So one of the other questions that was sent in was, you've discovered a lot of things, you've kind of learned a lot of things. What's the one thing that even for you is kind of mind-blowing?
Actually, I do have an answer to that. And it was a friend of mine, a colleague, Jeff Forshaw, who is a professor at Manchester as well. We've done a lot of research together, wrote a lot of books together. And we both agree that it's the fact that anything exists at all. So he said, give me one atom. Just give me the existence of an atom. And then I'm comfortable. Then I can see how things can develop, you know. But the fact that there is anything is surely the most profound question, because we don't understand what, even if there was an origin in time. So we know there was this hot and dense phase to the universe 13.8 billion years ago, because we've measured it. But what we don't know is what it means to say time began. Does that have any meaning at all? Just to say very briefly, the study of black holes at the moment is going through a revolution in the last few years. And we're beginning now to talk in terms of building blocks of space and time. So we're beginning to suspect, this is cutting edge stuff, but suspect that space and time emerge from some deeper structure that doesn't have them in it, which is a very strange thing to say. The example I have to give is like, you know, the other hard question in the universe is consciousness, right? What is this thing? Well, we know what it comes from. It comes from a load of atoms in a particular pattern, right? Which is a brain, which is just made of stuff, same stuff as this table. But we don't know how it emerges, and it's a remarkable thing. So in the same way, we begin to suspect space and time emerge from something else. And so until we know that, until we understand that, I don't think it makes any sense to talk about the origin of the universe at all.
Yeah.
So yeah, but that's a deep question, isn't it?
to answer in 20
only,
minutes.
The only interesting question in some sense is, why does anything exist?
Yeah.
Give me that and I'll make sense of it.
I don't know if I could answer that. No.
Wouldn't even like to begin to answer that. Do you find it difficult? I'm going off topic, off script here, but do you find not knowing difficult, or do you love not knowing and then wanting to find out?
No, we could talk about this in the context of engineering as well, but I said to the students this morning that if you think about what being a research scientist is, it's being delighted to stand on the edge of the known. That's what you do, because that's the job. So you're supposed to operate with excitement in that sort of looking out into the unknown. The same way, you know, we sat next to Concorde, just down there. I mean, that, you know, you could talk about that in terms of engineering. That was the unknown. I mean, to build a supersonic passenger airline, or actually anything supersonic, actually, here, if you're talking about the 1940s, you know, how do you break the sound barrier?
Yeah.
It's being delighted. And it's the same sense. It's the same as getting in a... It's not quite the same. I'm not going to claim that theoretical physics is the same as getting in an aircraft and putting it through the sound barrier for the first time. You know, I'm not going to be Chuck Yeager. There's a difference between Chuck Yeager and Einstein. But there isn't in some... To get to your question, it's about being delighted in pushing yourself into the unknown.
Yeah. So... Okay, let's. I'll come back to some of these other questions, because we've. I think this is relevant.
You've done it.
Here at Brooklands Today, there's 400 children on site, and part of what you want to do at Brooklands is inspire the next generation of STEM engineers, scientists, or mathematicians, or whatever. And so, I'd love you to kind of briefly talk about Brooklands and how Brooklands are doing that, and then I want to come on to how you're doing that in your own with your own son, let alone the 400 children here as well.
Yeah. I mean, Brooklands is an amazing place in its own right. I mean, it was built on failure, which sounds really silly, but you know, without the failure, there wouldn't have been the successes, and that's something that we really believe in. And you know, what's embedded within the Innovation Academy. You look at when they started building the racetrack in 1907 or 1906, they took 9 months to build it. And it was the first use of mass-produced concrete. It almost went bankrupt. all the failures stacked up against it. And then when they opened it, it started falling to pieces. But yet they kept on sticking it together, learned, you know, how to improve it. And the incremental development was just massive. And it's using those stories and being able to inform the next generation and inform the future through the past is really, really crucial to us. And it's creating tangible, relatable links to the past as well, that young people today can see what people have gone through. And I think that's really important, as, you know, people sell people. And if they can identify with individuals from the past, hear about the struggles that they've gone through to get where they are today, that can light a bit of a fire and ignite the passion. Yeah. Well, I can do that too. And then showing, you know, we're talking about new technologies today, but, you know, motoring and aviation were new technologies 100 years ago, and they were the cutting edge then. They're the norm now, but we're going through a transport revolution today, and actually we need the young people to see what happened then so they can be a part of the revolution to take us to the next step.
Yeah.
So 100 years in the future, the vehicles in 50 years' time are vintage classics, as it were, as well. But it's that cycle, isn't it, all the way through
there? It's amazing to be sat here, because we're looking at, you can't see. But if you turn around, you know, there's this Concorde there, and then there's, you know, what's that? That's a,
you've got Spitfire and Hurricane over there. You've got a Wellington bomber over there. You know, Concorde's behind you. That aircraft, what's really interesting there, that aircraft, Vickers Vimy, they successfully flew over the Atlantic in 1919 as part of the first ever non-stop flight between America to Europe, 1919. 1969, Concorde had its first test flight. There's 50 years between that flying on two Rolls-Royce Eagle engines and four Rolls-Royce Olympus supersonic.
Yeah.
And the mind just is blown.
It's by the living memory.
Living memory.
I mean, it's almost living memories. That would be just about people around you. Absolutely.
I love that, though. And it kind of goes on from your, when you were saying about standing on the edge of the unknown. This idea of failure and the unknown don't seem to be very comfortable concepts for young people today. I don't know about your own children, but how do you inspire your children to be comfortable with the unknown and failure?
It's how you learn. The thing about being a scientist is that, and an engineer actually, we'll start with the scientist. The thing about being a scientist is you have to be delighted when it turns out that you're wrong. Because when you're wrong, you've learned something about nature, and it's your job to understand nature. So having an idea about how something works and then finding out that's not the correct idea is tremendous progress. The reason I change it, because engineering is slightly different, because you don't want to be wrong with the shape of your wing. You know, something like that.
In test phase, maybe.
Designing aircraft. But broadly speaking, that's how the aviation is really becoming. That's how it's become safe to fly.
Absolutely.
Because every time something goes wrong, people don't shout at each other, they learn from it. That's the culture, it's engineering culture.
And it's creating that atmosphere, or that the environment that it's safe to fail in. You know, I have a daughter who is 10 years old, and for a number of years, she was afraid of putting her hand up in class to ask for help.
Yeah.
She's afraid of that, because you're constantly pushing for 10 out of 10s all the time. But actually, if she gets 3 out of 10 this time, but then gets 4 out of 10 the next time, that's to be celebrated, because you show that development. And it's flipping everything on its head.
Yeah.
And for far too long, we've been so focused on achieving up there rather than actually about the process.
Yeah.
And preparing young people in life is all about the process. It's not about the end result.
Yeah. The great Nobel Prize, I guess the Nobel Prize winner, Richard Feynman, he's one of the greatest physicists that ever lived. Nobel Prize for the quantum theory of electricity and magnetism. And he defined science as a satisfactory philosophy of ignorance, right? So it's merely satisfactory.
Yeah.
And it's a philosophy of ignorance, because the point is that you start out not knowing anything, and you make some guesses, and most of the guesses are wrong, and you do some observation, and you get a bit more insight, and that's how you proceed. That's how the modern world was built. That's how that thing
yeah. was built. It also sounds like parenting.
Absolutely.
You've got no idea what you're doing.
Absolutely still don't, but you just...
You're right, it's a tremendous problem, not only in schools, by the way, but I would venture in politics, in just not to be far too explicit about it, but the idea that it's hard to run a society, and the idea that you can try something and it doesn't quite work. And then the worst thing, can you imagine if you're an engineer building an aircraft and you get it wrong, but you try to tough it out.
Yeah, mm-hmm. and tell everyone it's right.
The aircraft wouldn't work
yeah.
if you'd done that. It's like Barnes Wallace's office. Right, you know, you've seen the film about the bouncing bomb. It was a process of getting it wrong because it's hard and getting it wrong again and getting it wrong and learning a bit. So the thing to tell children is that the greatest minds that built Concorde and understood nature, Einstein, everybody, yeah. all those people were delighted when they were wrong, ultimately, fundamentally, because that's part of the path to eventually getting it right.
Yeah, that is, well, that right there is quite powerful, isn't it? That message.
But we've lost it yeah. slightly. I do think in modern...
Oh, I agree.
Not only in schools, that actually... And it's not in schools, is it? Because teachers know that. It's actually, but somehow,
society in general,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah.
So how do we get that back? Like, what's the answer?
It's proclaim it loudly, isn't it? And that's why places like this are great, because this is engineering. You can see engineering in action here, can't you? The history of it. And
you can. Yeah. It's encouraged people to be hands-on and active and doing things differently in a different context. And, you know, it is shaking down the norms, absolutely encouraging.
Yeah. I mean, it amazes me that you can build something like Concorde at that time.
Without a computer
either. It's like, yeah, how do you do it with a slide rule?
It was insane. Slide rule, a bit of paper, yeah, and that's it. Exactly. Yeah. So, not even a calculator.
I mean, trying stuff. Absolutely. Building stuff and trying it.
That is also one of the questions that well, linked into one of the questions that came up, because the original space race was to the moon, which is also, you know, there were things that we couldn't do in the 60s, but we kind of send a man to the moon. And the focus was on the moon. Then recent years, it's kind of shifted more to Mars. But it feels like now, certainly from the media's point of view, it's going back to the moon. Why is that? I think there's something about water on the moon. But why is there now a focus back to moon?
Because in many ways, it's the stepping stone. So, I mean, it's by far the easiest place to go. I mean, it's in spaceflight terms, it's easy. Mars is extremely difficult. But also, I mean, you get to the question of why do we want to go anywhere? And actually, if you think about it, it's interesting. The moon and Mars are the only two places we can actually go in any on any conceivable timescale. Certainly, Mars is the only planet other than Earth we can land on ever, because we're not going to Mercury because it's too hot. We're not going to Venus because it really is too hot. And Venus are made of gas.
Yeah.
So we're not going
to land.
So it's ultimately, if you're going to become a spacefaring civilization and move outwards, and we're talking about practicality. We've already industrialized Earth orbit. That's one of the things we're talking about today with careers. I mean, one of the great success stories in British engineering is space engineering. And it's not just building probes that go to Mars to look for life, it's building communication satellites and weather satellites and all this stuff. So we've already industrialized Earth orbit. So the natural next step is to the moon and to the asteroids, vast reservoir of resources. And so I think it's inevitable that if we are going to grow our civilization, we will have to grow that way. We're seeing problems with growing on the surface of the planet. We're causing problems. So it makes sense to me in the medium to long term to begin to go outwards. And the moon is the easiest first step.
Do you think that will happen, that we will have civilization on the moon?
We will have a base on the moon quite soon. I mean, NASA's plan is for the Lunar Gateway Station, which is a staging post on the way to the surface. And we can all argue about whether, because we're on the web, people lie, but whether that's sensible or not, because there's a lot of debate about it, actually.
Yeah.
But ultimately, the next place beyond the International Space Station that we go will be a moon base. And you said there is the resources there, so it makes sense. I mean, water's critical. If you can find accessible water, which it seems that we can, in the South Pole or somewhere like that, then it makes sense to go and stick a base there because you've got everything you need. Because all you need is water.
Yeah. Coming back around, have we got time? 1 minute.
That's a broad debate.
Okay, one more. From a point of view of being dads, but also having incredible knowledge of the world around you and understanding of the world around you, what do you think should be the largest concern that parents have in terms of raising the next generation? That's the question.
Oh, God. That's open-ended.
I talked about the moon base.
It's terrifying when you start looking at the next 50 years, even 25 years, in terms of, you know, fuel, food, water, everything. You know, the world is warming up. You know, the world has never been static in terms of environment. You know, for 10,000 years, you know, the climate has changed, but we seem to be in a rapid process at the moment. That is a real concern. And the shifting of the seasons, absolutely everything. I think all of that combined, that is, you know, as a dad, that terrifies me to think what my kids are going to be facing and their kids in the future as well. But they've also, flip side, they've got the power to be able to do something about it.
Yes, the challenge now is how to manage a planet.
Yeah.
For the first time, really, in human history, we are faced with that challenge. And it's a political challenge, ultimately. We know how to do it. So we have the engineering expertise. We have the technology, we're smart enough to manage a planet technically, but the question is, are we smart enough politically? And so that's a challenge to that generation, actually. It can be done, but I hope that they become more skilled politically than our generation.
Yeah.
That's the hope.
I agree with that.
Well, I'd love to go on on and on and go into some of these subjects on a deeper level, but that was super helpful. One really quick question, I promise, it's just a yes or, well, almost yes or no, and I think it came from one of the dad's children, but do you think there is life out there?
Yes, but if I was to guess, I would say that you would have to go a very long way to find another civilization, potentially outside our galaxy. So you can make an argument that the average number of civilizations per galaxy is closer to zero even than one or two or 10 or 20 or 100. So you can make that argument. It's basically, I know it's a long answer to your question, it's based on the amount of time it took from the origin of life on Earth to go to a civilization. It's about 4 billion years. So on this planet, it took one third of the age of the universe to go from cell to civilization. And if that's in any way typical, and we don't know, then even given some cells on Mars or Jupiter's moon Europa or somewhere, the idea that you can get to something like this, like Brooklands, and you know, is that's probably a big ask.
Okay, so we've ended in a way that's blown my mind.
Going back to what we said earlier, the responsibility of the next generation, our generation. The responsibility is to hand the Earth over intact to our children, first of all.
Yeah.
It's not exactly clear that we're going to manage that one, but assuming we can hand it over intact, their challenge might be to ensure that the only civilization currently in the Milky Way galaxy persists and expands outwards.
Wow.
And so there is a responsibility, I think. We might as well assume that is the position that we find ourselves in. Focus is the mind. Fiddling, tinkering politicians who can't get their act together to make sure that this civilization persists.
Fantastic. Well, let's leave it there. It's been a real pleasure. Thank you very much for joining us on the podcast. If people want to visit Brooklands, we'll drop a link in the description.
Well, check our website.
Definitely recommend it for a family day out. People will know where to find you.
Somewhere.
We'll Google. Thank you very much. Guys.
A Dad's Net original podcast.